This is an ABC podcast.
This is the Victorian Country Hour with Isabella Pittaway on ABC Radio Victoria.
Hello, Isabella Pittaway with you for the Country Hour on what is an unseasonably warm day. Coming up, Coles has partnered with SPC to produce a new range of locally farmed fruit products. But at $2 a can, farmers aren't all too happy with the new deal, likening it to $1 per litre milk.
The consumer needs to ask themselves, when they go to a supermarket and they see a litre of milk for a buck, or almost a kilogram of fruit, with all the processing facility costs that go into that for $2, you know, ask yourself the question, do you think there'll be a fair reward for a farmer at the other end of that?
Also today, bad news for livestock producers. Hay prices are continuing to rise as the dry conditions roll on. Not only is it expensive, it's also proving hard to find. That story is coming up after the weather. But first, and I'd love you to have the text number ready for this, it's 0467 842 722. The future of the dairy industry is yet again up for discussion. Dairy Australia's leadership team is in Gippsland today talking with farmers about its Australian dairy plan. It wants to find out from industry what its top priorities are for the next 5 years, with the goal to create a more profitable, united industry. Some farmers have questioned the need for more consultation at a time where farmers are leaving the industry in droves, particularly in northern Victoria. Earlier, I spoke to Dairy Australia Chairman Jeff Odgers.
The dairy industry nationally is currently challenged in a number of ways, and in recent years we've had a lot of volatility in markets and climate, currently faced by some pretty challenging dry conditions right up and down the eastern seaboard. But this Australian Dairy Plan is really about priority setting for the industry in a national sense for the next 5 years, even though we're currently experiencing dry seasonal conditions.
I was reading on your website about the plan. It says to navigate these challenges and to be a strong, united force, farmers, processors and the broader dairy community need to work together and speak with one voice. Are you suggesting that there hasn't been a united voice in the dairy industry in the past?
I think given the pressures that we've seen right throughout the industry, there's always... There's a risk that we're not as cohesive as we should be, and that we're not talking as much as we should be, and we really do need to return to being more profitable, and that brings more confidence, and I think when we're in that shape, we're more united, and we're having much better outcomes for industry.
And on the having a united voice on these issues, what other dairy groups are involved in this plan? I mean, we have the state groups like the UDV, we've got Farmer Power. Are they involved in this plan?
They certainly are involved in this plan, and very much a part of working together on the engagement phase. At a national level, we've got the Australian Dairy Farmers, the Australian Dairy Products Federation, Dairy Australia and Gardner Foundation.
You mentioned before that farmers are facing pressures, whether it be with the drought or water access, pricing. There's been a lot of issues in the industry already for the past 3 years. We've had consultation on the state of the dairy industry over the past year or so. Why is this conversation about the future still happening? Why isn't there actions already in place?
The respective national organisations all go through strategic planning processes every 3 to 5 years. And we're at a juncture late in 2018 when we decided that we were all about to step into this phase of strategic planning for the whole industry in our respective areas, and that there would be huge merit in doing that together. And the emphasis on which priorities we really need to work on nationally will feed back into those respective strategic plans beyond this process, which will... The engagement phase is happening in May and June. We really encourage all people that are involved in the industry, farmers, processors, service providers and other interested people to attend those sessions and to have their say.
Jeff, you haven't really touched on what actions are actually taking place at the moment to help farmers battling this issue. You've been talking about developing a strategic plan for the next 5 years, but there are ongoing issues that are affecting farmers now. We're seeing lots of farmers leave the dairy industry. There are dairy farms closing weekly. What's being done to address those concerns, which we already know about? What's being done to address them now?
Look, we've got programs I guess we're taking to farmers as organisations on a regular basis. I'm in Gippsland today and visiting farms in the Maffra and at Yarram, where it's particularly dry. Those farms, the farmers in those regions have in recent times been able to attend events which are providing practical information on the seasonal settings and things that they might consider doing in a management sense. Beyond that, we're doing one-on-one farm visits with farmers where they wish to look into further planning around finances and feed budgeting. There are a range of supports.
And a lot of them are in place from Agriculture Victoria. But my question to you was really about what is Dairy Australia doing now? We know that these issues are in place. Farmers have said in response to this plan that this is just more consultation, more chit-chat, it's a joke. Why isn't it being fixed? Farmers have been asking, we know the problems that exist. We need to be working on them for the future. What is Dairy Australia doing about those concerns?
Well, I mean, Dairy Australia runs a suite of programs that three-quarters of our funding for programs goes towards programs that farmers can pick up around food planning, animals, farm business management, working on people initiatives, NRM. So they are there through the regional development programs like Gifts Dairy.
What about trying to you know, one in four dairy farmers leaving the industry, weekly closures of dairy farms? We've seen, you know, in Deniliquin, one of the last remaining dairies there has closed. We're seeing lots of them close in northern Victoria. Farmers are seeing that and thinking, what's actually being done to make sure that, you know, there is a future for the Australian dairy industry? What's being done from Dairy Australia's point of view?
Look, I've been in agriculture a long time, and the dairy industry supports each other like no other industry, and bodies like Dairy Australia run a suite of programs that farmers can access on a regular basis if they choose to. In terms of exits, yes, we are having some exits out of northern Victoria. These are quite extreme conditions at the moment on the back of a number of tough years, and farmers are making some difficult decisions. We are doing everything we can to assist in getting that the best outcomes. Farmers that choose to continue farming and also for those that decided they plan to exit.
Just lastly, Jeff, how will this Australian Dairy Plan fix or help the future of the dairy industry?
Well, look, I'm going to stop there.
And that's where we finished the interview. That's Dairy Australia Chairman Jeff Odgers. Well, do you think this national plan is the best way forward for the dairy industry? I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can send me a text on 0467 842 722. That's 0467 842 722.
The Victorian Country Hour with Isabella Pittaway on ABC Radio Victoria.
where it is a quarter past 12. Supermarket giant Coles is partnering with canned fruit company SPC to produce a new range of canned products. The two-year supply deal will see an additional 1.8 million cans of Australian fruit being processed every year, with four new products, including canned peaches, pears, apricots, and fruit salad. But at $2 a can, fruit growers aren't all happy about the Coles deal, likening the pricing to $1 a litre milk. Mahalia Dobson is speaking to head of Coles, Mark Field.
There's an opportunity for us to bring products to the market that we know our customers want, but at the same time supporting an Australian business and important Australian farmers. We were up at the factory last week ahead of the launch. We met some growers and they were really pleased in the stability that this two-year agreement gave their business. And what we felt it would do for the community. So I was really delighted to have the opportunity to talk to some of the growers directly and really understand the passion and the commitment behind the products they're producing us, but more importantly, understand what the deal meant for them. And it was really significant. So the grower we met last week, extremely positive, could really understand the need for us to bring these products to market under our brand, really appreciated the opportunity and the business opportunity it gave them to sell the products into the retail sector, because their fruit couldn't be eaten unless it's canned. The variety of products, particularly pears in this case, as one of the examples, you need to can it to give it the eating experience for a customer. It's not something you would eat fresh.
Maroopna orchardist Peter Hall welcomed the announcement by Coles and argued that any deal that's done to take Australian-grown products and put them on Australian shelves for Australian consumption in a competitive way is a good deal. But he said he had concerns about the cheap price at which these products were being sold.
People in Australia want to buy the high-quality, clean, green product that we grow. You've got to ask yourself the question, is $2 a fair price to pay for almost a kilogram of fruit? I mean, a chocolate bar or an ice cream would cost more than that. But here you've got almost a kilogram of product that's blood, sweat and tears of farmers and a huge processing facility in SPC that, you know, costs a lot of money, employs a lot of people to get that product into a can. You've got to ask yourself the question whether the value's there for a farmer. People need to consider what goes into making food products. And the inherent costs and the effort that goes into that. And I think Australians have got to maybe rethink the way they value farmers' efforts. I mean, a retailer will retail what they believe the value they can sell for. That's another question. But in terms of a consumer needs to ask themselves, when they go to a supermarket and they see a litre of milk for a buck or almost a kilogram of fruit with all the processing facility costs that go into that for $2, you know, ask yourself the question, do you think there'll be a fair reward for a farmer at the other end of that? That's a real challenge for primary production in Australia, the way that consumers value what we do. The whole reason why some of the costs in Australia are high, because we go to an awful lot of care to produce a high-quality, good-tasting, clean, chemically-free product. And then sometimes some of these low prices are slapped on there. It's really, a comment on how much people value what farmers do to some extent.
The deal comes after Coca-Cola Amatil last year slashed the value of SPC in its account by $147 million to zero and announced that it was selling the struggling fruit cannery. In a statement, CCA says the announcement is good news for SPC. It is unclear how the deal will affect the cannery's future, though, with CCA saying negotiations started about 12 months ago and are therefore unrelated to the sale process. CCA says there has been strong interest from several bidders and an announcement will be made by the middle of the year. SPC declined the ABC's request to comment.
That was Mahalia Dobson with that report. And I'm asking you today what you think about this national dairy plan that Dairy Australia is working on. Is it the best way forward for the dairy industry? You can let me know by texting 0467 842 722. That's what an anonymous texter here has put. You can share your name and where you're from as well if you'd like. This text says, milk needs to increase in price now to $3 a litre, and that actually needs to go to the farmers. Supermarkets are rich enough. No one would begrudge the hard-working humans who work to provide it. Thank you for your text. You can share your thoughts on 0467 842 722. Well, regenerative agriculture is making its way further into the public consciousness. But just what are the benefits? For Chairman of Resource Consulting Services, or RCS Australia, David McLean, it's a practice that helps find balance when, let's be honest, an average year of rainfall is a unicorn. Melanie Groves asked him, just how can graziers make it profitable?
Working with nature is the first thing you've got to do. If you're fighting against nature, Mother Nature's going to win. So step one is to actually work out what can you do to work with your ecosystem. When you start to work with that, it actually is quite synergistic. What plants need, they want grazing and then they want rest. And what animals want is they want a good quality grass to go with that. And so if we're working in with nature, we're going to have a better quality of grass growing and we're going to have better quality leaf on there, which is going to increase digestibility. When we get more diversity, you're going to increase the average available nutrition through that pasture as well. The more diversity you've got, the more choice the animals have got, the more healthy their diet's going to be. When we line all those factors up and little things like matching stocking rate to carrying capacity, that's the situation where we're going to start to find that animal performance increases. And if we work with our grasses and manage for healthy perennial grasses, then we're going to get deeper, healthier root systems. Deeper, healthier root systems is going to increase organic matter, which is going to increase organic carbon, which increases water use efficiency, which actually increases carrying capacity. The converse of all that is if we're not managing for deep, healthy root systems, our water cycle drops, and therefore our carrying capacity drops, and therefore potential productivity drops. So everything's interlinked. Nothing is separate. Nothing can be completely looked at in isolation. When we know how to work with our country and we work with the grasses that we actually have, we can create a better outcome for animal performance as well as land management, as well as for business performance. And usually if you've got animals that are performing well and good pastures in your paddock, then that goes a hell of a long way for people's contentment and happiness as well.
I think an argument people might make when they're talking about this is in order to get their pasture to potentially regenerate like that, they feel that they'd have to take a lot of their livestock off that land, and some would ask, how can they afford to do that?
The short answer is you can't afford not to. If you don't match stocking rate to carrying capacity, the cost of that is you're either going to have to bring in other external feed, and we've all seen the last couple of years how expensive that is. So what is the cost of that? And all your death rates have gone up and all your productivity's dropped. So when we actually get into it, if your stocking rate, the number of mouths you've got, exceeds your carrying capacity, the amount of grass you've grown, there are no good outcomes from that. It's uneconomical and it degrades our ecological capital. And a lot of it links back to riding the unicorn. Still, I had a gentleman ask me that today, so if I've got breeders, how do I adjust my numbers? And I think, well, the first thing is we've got to think about how many breeders can you run in all seasons, and then think about having variability within your stocking numbers. Coming back to those examples too, I gave a lot of those clients and that we've seen that have matched stocking rate to carrying capacity, they're now in a position to be buying out their neighbours. The challenge for people to ask which side of the fence do they want to be on? Do they want to be the ones buying additional properties or the ones being bought out because they've degraded their business and ecology?
Talking about regenerative agriculture, it is something, it's turned into, and I hate to say it, but a bit of a buzzword. Do you feel that that's accurately representing what it means to do regenerative agriculture?
No, I think the term is fast becoming bastardised, and which I think is a real shame because it's such a... If we're doing truly regenerative, and the reason we've used regenerative for a number of years now before it became sexy was, if as opposed to sustainability, if we have sustained the health of a lot of landscapes in agriculture, we're in a pretty bad position because we need to actually increase productivity. Costs are going up. We need to be actually able to get more productivity off the same parcel of land. And so regenerating is when we're actually improving. And I think it's a great word, and where people are being what I would consider to be truly regenerative, where they're profitably increasing their land health, it's a wonderful outcome for them, for their families, for their local communities. You've got businesses that can continue to reinvest back in that area. And I think if we just the alternative, and where I think the term has been misused now, is it's just about getting land health, and it's about doing some of the fluffy things around making some land look pretty, but it may not actually be healthy, and there's no point being in the green if you're in the red. We've got to be profitable.
That's Chairman of RCS David McLean talking to Melanie Groves. More text coming in on this national dairy plan that Dairy Australia is working on. Mick from Rochester has texted in. He's not happy with our interview with the Dairy Australia chairman, saying Dairy Australia can only do so much. At the end of the day, they don't control the weather, input costs or milk price. The decision to stay in the industry or exit is the farmer's call. There are numerous programs to help make these decisions regionally. Thanks for sharing your thoughts, Mick. Also on this issue, here's another text. Dairy industry leaders should not have let the industry get to this point. All of these leaders are going on an industry junket all over Australia asking farmers how to fix the industry at our cost. Dairy Australia doesn't have an idea. We have been dairy farmers for four generations. We cannot go any longer milked dry. Thank you for your text as well. You can share your thoughts with me on 0467 842 722.
On ABC Radio Victoria, you're with Isabella Pittaway for the Victorian Country Hour.
Agriculture Victoria is reminding farmers to keep an eye on stock water supplies, with dams drying up as the dry conditions roll on. Dirty water can cause diseases like E. coli and botulism. Greg Becker, a land management officer with Agriculture Victoria, says farmers should do a budget to calculate how much water they're using.
So a water budget basically just looks at how much water the farming business is going to use, so how much their animal system, how much their infrastructure will use, the house, any sheds, dairy, if it's in a dairy enterprise. And then the other one is looking how much water they can actually store.
So is that a pretty straightforward calculation by those on the land? Do most people know how to do that?
That's an interesting question. We have an online calculator. I've been running these types of events and planning workshops, and I would have to say that very few people have a really good handle on how much water they actually use and how much their farming system does use.
Thinking about water quality and quantity for livestock, what are you encouraging landholders to do there?
So at the moment we'd be suggesting that if your water levels are getting lower and you've got a concern with respect to salt, for example, healthy production for dairy cows, 2,500 parts per million is the recommendation, and once you get above that you start to suffer production loss, and it's okay for the animals to drink, but those dissolved salts is something that we would be encouraging people to measure, and then once you know what that is, you can put something in place to manage that. And for example, some people have been shanding one lot of water with another lot of water to decrease those salt content.
What other factors are there that farmers, what they should consider with when it comes to water?
The big one at the moment potentially is blue-green algae, and as water levels decrease you tend to get a nutrient increase, and there's a potential for blue-green algae outbreak. So once again we would be strongly suggesting that if you've got doubts then send a sample away, because not all blue-green algae are blue-green algae, and it's very easy to make an assumption that it is when it actually isn't.
And also, I suppose, with the windy, dusty weather, sediment collecting in dams, manure, that kind of thing that gets blown along wouldn't help either.
No, those things certainly add to the problems, in terms of putting more sediment into your dam, so when it does rain, you've got less water in there, but also in terms of turbidity and animals, you know, standing in the water and with feces and those sorts of things.
I understand there's an on-farm emergency water infrastructure rebate scheme. How does that work?
That's up to 25% paid, up to a maximum of $25,000. So, for example, if you spend $100,000 on water infrastructure, you could get $25,000 back or parts thereof. And that's to do with anything that's going to make your farming system much more reliable into the future with regards to water. It's through Rural Finance at www.ruralfinance.com.au.
And just thinking further about the issues that can arise from livestock drinking poor quality water. You talked about salt, you talked about sediment and also algae. But with livestock that is being fed grain, adjusting to grain, I understand if the water quality isn't so good there, it can give them a few issues as well.
Yes, certainly that's the case. And we have to remember that we're paying generally lots of money to buy in fodder, and it's very expensive this year, so you want to be making the most of that sort of fodder and getting the best return on investment, so making sure that you've got good clean water to assist with that process is really critical. And when you're dry feeding, and predominantly people are feeding grain and hay, there's certainly not as much moisture in that as there would be in a normal grazing system, so animals' intake in water is obviously going to be higher.
That was Greg Becker from Agriculture Victoria speaking there to Cherie von Hirschner. It is 12:30, so it's time for us to find out what's making news headlines. It's good afternoon to Amelia Bernasconi.
Good afternoon, Isabella. Making news, a deer has attacked and killed a man and seriously injured a woman in Victoria's northeast. It's believed the couple was walking on their property at Market Road in Moyu, south of Wangaratta, just before 8:30 this morning when the animal came out of the bush and gored the man. He died a short time later. The woman has been flown to hospital with life-threatening injuries. Police expect to charge a 14-year-old boy over a bushfire that destroyed one structure and several vehicles near Ballarat yesterday. Dozens of people were forced to evacuate their properties after the blaze threatened homes near a pine plantation. A 14-year-old boy has been interviewed by police and is expected to be charged on summons with arson-related offences. A South Gippsland Shire councillor has been granted bail as he faces a series of drugs charges. Councillor Jeremy Rich has been charged with possession and cultivation of a drug after police allegedly found 21 kilograms of dried cannabis and 8 cannabis plants at a Walkerville property owned by his family. White powder and blue pills were also allegedly found during the raid on Monday. The matter returns to court in July. The federal court has squashed Environment Minister Melissa Price's decision not to grant protection to trees that would be removed if a Western Victorian highway duplication goes ahead. Last year, Jabwarang traditional owners appealed to Ms. Price to protect the trees, saying they're sacred, but the minister rejected their application in December. But now a federal court judge has squashed the minister's decision, which was deemed to be affected by an error of law, and she's been ordered to make a fresh decision. And for more news anytime, you can visit abc.net.au/news.
Thanks, Amelia. That's Amelia Bernasconi there with the news headlines. Well, it's timely now to cross to the Weather Bureau. I've been waiting for it to tick over to 30 here in Sale. It was 29.7 when I entered the studio. Let's see where it's at now. It's a good afternoon to senior forecaster Dean Stewart.
Yeah, good afternoon, Isabella. Well, the good news is if you're looking for it to tick over, it has certainly ticked over. In fact, right at the minute, 31.8 degrees in East Sale, which is fourth on the list if we look at the temperatures this minute around the state. In fact, it's actually third on the list this minute. We've got temperatures... my screen's just refreshing.
You're right. While that's loading, I would just like to clarify, I would much prefer it's raining in Gippsland than it be 31.7.
Yes. But Walpyup's on top of the list, 32.2. Swan Hill not far behind, 32.1. So you're not far behind them. Certainly very warm conditions, not only there, but over a good part of the state. Temperatures either already in the high 20s or moving into the low 30s. One area it is a little bit cooler is that southwest corner of the state. We have had some cloud cover and even some shower activity over that southwest corner. So temperatures down there around Portland, Warrnambool area, generally around the mid-20s, around 24, 25 degrees. I did mention some rainfall down that way. The highest rainfall since 9 a.m. this morning has been 2.8 millimetres at Portland, 2.2 at Cape Nelson and 2 millimetres at Dartmoor. So right in that southwest corner. I think for the early part of this afternoon, that's where the shower activity will remain. However, late this afternoon into this evening, as a frontal system pushes across from the west, those showers will gradually work their way a little further eastwards. But unfortunately, very little looks to be going to make it up north of the ranges over northern Victoria. So it's really confined to southern Victoria. And I think even as this system pushes further eastwards, the totals will tend to taper off as well. So we may accumulate totals as high as 5 millimetres over parts of the southwest, particularly down in that southwest corner. But further eastwards, we'll be struggling to get more than a couple of millimetres in any gauge. That front will bring some cooler air in behind it, particularly across southern Victoria tomorrow. So whilst those temperatures today, as I said, are expected to peak either a high 20s or into the low 30s through much of the state, with southerly winds coming behind it tomorrow, we'll be back to the high teens through much of southern Victoria, maybe just sneak the odd 20 degree temperature tomorrow. In the north, they'll still get into the low 20s through much of the state. The area that probably be warmest tomorrow will be the northeast corner. We're looking at around 27 degrees at Albury-Wodonga. Any showers left with this front will be confined largely to Gippsland, I think, by dawn. There'll still be a couple over central Victoria just after midnight, but by dawn tomorrow, some isolated showers left in Gippsland, and they'll tend to clear as the day progresses. The rest of the state, partly cloudy skies through the south. We should see mostly sunny skies up over the north. Following that, the next high comes in fairly quickly behind this frontal system. So the winds on Friday will be back to very light winds across the state and a return to sunny skies right across the state as well. And that will mean the temperatures will creep back up into the mid-20s across the north and getting into the low 20s through southern Victoria, although the winds will be light enough that anywhere right down near the coast will probably feel the effects of a sea breeze, and that will probably just knock a couple of degrees off the temperature there. On Saturday, remaining dry across the state as the winds tend back to the north, and that will bring some of that warm air back across the state. So high 20s or even into the low 30s up in the northwest corner of the state over northern Victoria. The south will get to the mid to high 20s as well. And then we'll get the next front coming across on Sunday. Once again, it doesn't look like delivering much in the way of rainfall, just a smattering of showers coming across with it. Most totals, again, likely to be less than 5 millimetres. And in the case of the north, probably, I think they will get the odd shower up over northern Victoria, but hardly enough to register in the gauges. It will mean a cooler day to end Easter on Monday in the southerly winds behind that front. So back to the mid to high teens in the south and just into the low 20s in the north. So a bit of a mixed bag, but certainly a warm start. Well, Friday into Saturday, a warm start to Easter. And for much of eastern Victoria, Sunday will be warm as well. That front won't reach that area until very late in the day. And then into early next week, it looks like the cool conditions behind that front on Monday will probably linger into Tuesday. Any shower activity left behind that front will clear up as well. So we're still looking for that decent rainfall, but certainly in the next 7 days, it doesn't look like happening at this stage, Isabella.
No, it doesn't. And we could be breaking heat records instead.
Yes, that's right. In fact, even last night, we set some pretty significant records. Cape Otway, which has over 150 years of records, had their warmest ever night for April on record, 23.3 degrees, beat the previous record, which was set way back in 1886 by more than a degree. So,
wow.
So, quite significant records. And a lot of places, even they mightn't have set new April minimum records, but for this late in April, they've set some records. So it's quite extraordinary.
Dean, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Isabella.
That's Senior Forecaster Dean Stewart at the Weather Bureau. You are listening to the Country Hour and my name's Isabella Pittaway. Now, as we heard earlier in the news headlines, there's been a fatality on a property at Moreu, which is near Wangaratta. It appears that a man has been attacked and killed by a deer. ABC Goulburn Murray reporter Ashley Aldridge is at Moreu and she joins us now. Good afternoon, Ashley.
Good afternoon.
Ashley, what's happened today?
Well, what we know so far is that it's understood a man and a woman were attacked by a deer on their property at Moreu. Now, that's just south of Wangaratta in the state's northeast. details are still still coming through at the moment, but what we do know is both the man and the woman suffered critical injuries. However, police have confirmed that the man did die a short time later at the scene. Now, the woman has been airlifted to hospital. She's suffering from life-threatening injuries. We are expecting an update from police on those injuries, but obviously the investigation is still ongoing at the moment.
And what's happened to the deer?
Police have confirmed that the deer was euthanised by police at the scene. Other than that, we don't really have many more details. The property is actually in the centre of town, but as you can imagine, in these rural communities, it is quite a large property just behind the centre of town. But obviously, the details are still really unfolding here at the moment.
And Ashley, are there many wild deer in that area normally? Like, are they common up there or...?
There is a really large deer population here. The area has been actually known to have community meetings in the past to talk about how to address the issue of the deer population in the region.
Ashley, appreciate your time.
No worries at all. Thank you.
That's ABC Goulburn Murray reporter Ashley Aldridge at Moy U near Wangaratta. There has been a fatality on a property up there. A man has been attacked and killed by a deer, and a woman is also in a serious condition in hospital.
You're with Isabella Pittaway for the Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
And it is 19 minutes to one. Well, it's bad news for livestock producers as hay prices are continuing to rise as the dry conditions roll on. Not only is it expensive, but it's hard to find, and a lot of what can be seen in sheds and stacks is already sold. Colin Peace from Jumbuck Consulting told Angus Verley good quality hay is selling for more than $300 a tonne.
There's been a steady increase in hay prices since spring baling last year. The market definitely dipped from the peak of early spring last year, and since then it's probably come back about between $30 and $50 a tonne. But since the end of February, I would suggest, there's been a constant, steady, sometimes, $5 a week increase. It's just a steady increase, not every week. We've got cereal hay now tracking constantly $320 to $330 a tonne, ex Mallee Farm, for instance, and in very short supply. The canola hay has had a similar trajectory, I would suggest, and it proved to be a little bit difficult to sell, and I think the canola growers were a bit disillusioned at the start whether they were going to actually find a home for their canola hay that they had reluctantly cut from their canola crops. But canola hay is proving very popular, and it's getting snapped up as well. And any decent sort of protein, it's probably tracking a $290 to $300, even $310 ex farm.
So for those that are in the market now trying to buy hay, are they having to lower their standards and become less fussy, I suppose?
Look, that's true. And there's a hay out there for everyone. And there has been a lot of people, you can halve the price for hay and go out and buy straw and mix it up with some other grains and some other feed ingredients, and you can get yourself a ration. It's not impossible. So there are options out there. There are even people baling up corn stubble and rice straw from the summer crops in the MIA and CIA. So they're out there, but it's looking like the probably the lowest carry in of hay that we've ever had at the end of winter last year is starting to bite. And hay stocks are getting drawn down, and people can see that, and that's why they're sort of entering the market and trying to secure what they need for autumn, plus get a little bit of hay up their sleeve for winter as well.
And you mentioned they're baling corn stubble. That does seem to be a pretty glaring snapshot, I suppose, of the lengths that people are going to. Whether they can't source hay or whether they're not prepared to pay the prices that are being asked and choosing to bale that corn stubble instead.
Look, you're right. And it's a barometer of a pretty tight hay supply when you see either of those commodities being baled up, rice straw or corn dover. If you've got a market for that, you know that the other pasture hay, cereal hay and veg hay has been well and truly picked over. You've still got a lot of demand for the beef feedlots in New South Wales that need fibre, and they're the ones who can very cleverly put together rations, and all they need is a palatable source of fibre just to sort of get the rumen functioning well, and they're probably the key runners for that sort of stuff. But there are other sheep and beef producers who can also do something with those types of fodders and put together some energy and protein sources to make them work. So it's not impossible.
Looking at the season ahead, it does seem that those long-term hay producers fare better in drier years because they're still able to salvage something. Do you think, with some indications that this year could be dry, that we'll see more hay crops go in?
There'd be a tendency for people to see, look, you know, hay is selling well. I think people generally stick to their own rotations. The agronomy these days is fairly well attuned. But, of course, if you're growing wheat and barley crops and you get a dry spring, you know, there are options there around cutting it for domestic hay needs. The exception there is that if you're growing hay for export, you probably need to make a dedicated crop from the first place. There are special ways you need to prepare your paddock, and the herbicides are different for export hay. And I think there are more plants now in Victoria and more export open hay plants. So I think there probably will be a greater increase in open hay sown this year, but it's probably just on the back of fundamental demand from the new plants that are going in.
That was hay market analyst Colin Peace speaking there to Angus Verley. More texts coming through off the back of our interview with Dairy Australia earlier in the show, and whether a national plan is the best way forward for the dairy industry, and whether more consultation is needed at the moment and what they're doing to help the industry. Steve from Yalka is disappointed with Dairy Australia, saying the industry is just about buggered up here in northern Victoria. Water just hit $600, milk now costing $1 a litre to produce, and we get 50 cents. Thanks for your text, Steve. Another person saying that the best way forward for dairy in northern Victoria is to sell the water, sell the cows and get out. Roy from Orbost says that the speaker at the start of the program was the worst they'd heard. Another dairy farmer from Gippsland saying that Dairy Australia can't make it rain. There are many challenges to agribusinesses across Australia. Not a constructive interview. Planning ahead is important, particularly in tough times. Thanks for your feedback. Another text here saying, if Dairy Australia can't show leadership and help to fix the farm gate price, then why have them? You can share your thoughts and have your say by texting 0467 842 722.
The Victorian Country Hour with Isabella Pittaway on ABC Radio Victoria.
Where it is 12 minutes to one. Armed with clipboards, fruit growers and agronomists have been on a bug hunt. It was all part of a mock surveillance exercise organised by Fruit Growers Victoria, CESA and Agriculture Victoria to provide some tips and practice for identifying and recording exotic pests as part of a biosecurity blitz. Simone Smith went along to find out how to identify the little critters that could cause huge problems for horticulture.
There's a lot of general tips that apply no matter what you're looking for, but you can really make good decisions if you know just a little bit about pest biology.
That's entomologist Aliyah Patel from Agricultural Research and Pest Control Business CESA, speaking to growers and agronomists as part of the Biosecurity Blitz workshop at Tatura.
One of the diseases we're looking at today is plum pox, and it's really useful to know that that gets transferred by aphids. So if you're trying to decide, well, where should I go surveying for plum pox damage? If you've got an area in your orchard where you know there's been a history of aphids, that's a great place to start. Similarly, there's some tips that can help you really optimize surveillance for brown marmorated stink bug, another hot topic critter at the moment. And as far as the damage that stink bug creates, They might start feeding in the spring, but their damage takes weeks sometimes to develop. So you get the most bang for your buck if you're doing your surveying in the summer and even around harvest time. So that's the sort of information we're trying to put together into surveillance guides that we can provide growers and also gardeners to help them optimize their surveillance.
Elizabeth Mace, Fruit Growers Deputy Chair and GV Crop Protection Pest and Disease Specialist, was taking no biosecurity chances.
I have a pair of gumboots. I have a breathable moon suit, I suppose you'd call it, and a pair of gloves. I've been through a chlorine bath, which is 10% alcohol chlorine, so that I'm not going to be transporting any pathogens through the research.
Everybody's searching through the orchards now with clipboards looking for signs of damage. What's the chances of finding it? Are we finding a needle in a haystack?
Hopefully. They have seeded the orchards, so they have put a few out there, but they're not real, they're pretend, but they have seeded the orchard to make sure we've got our eyes open. So our chances are probably pretty high that we are going to find it, but it is a mock, so they're not going to be real.
Aliyah stressed the importance of standardising surveillance.
And the reason it's important to be trying to standardise the surveillance you do on your own farm or in your own garden is, in the event that you do have an exotic pest breaking out in an area near you, if you can be providing information to government that shows you've actually been doing surveillance in your own area and you've been doing it to a standard that is the same as what government surveillance would look like, you've been recording the same data, you've been making decisions about how to survey that is appropriate to the pest or disease you're looking for, it's really going to help you show that your area is or isn't affected by a pest and can be really important when it comes time to decide which areas are free of the pest and which areas need to be quarantined or have closer inspection.
You were talking in there before about recording your exact location on your mobile phone. Can you explain how that works?
Yeah, so it's having a latitude and longitude coordinate for any sample you collect. If you find a bug, you're not sure if it's a marmorated stink bug or not, or if you find some leaves that look like maybe they're affected by a disease that could be exotic, getting the latitude and longitude is really important. And these days, if you have a smartphone, pretty much everybody can get that just by opening up Google Maps on their smartphone. And it's really just a matter of clicking on the spot on the map on the screen and a little window will pop up and give you a latitude and longitude.
You also mentioned storing them if they did find something suspect. You mentioned putting it in the fridge. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Generally, our advice when you're storing something that you think could be exotic is to get it contained, usually in a rigid plastic airtight container, whether that's some leaves that look like it's got suspicious disease or whether it's a live insect or eggs. If you put them in a sealed plastic container and you put them in the fridge, that's going to keep them alive or, you know, not kind of molding or becoming hard to identify long enough for you to call the exotic plant pest hotline and get further advice on what to do with those samples.
What do they do to crops?
Well, so the brown marmorated stink bug in particular can damage crops in a variety of ways. It's all based off of the feeding. They inject their little mouth part like a straw down into the fruit. That can let in bacteria. It can let in fungus. It can cause the fruit to rot that way. It can cause the fruit to look kind of shriveled around harvest, which makes it unsuitable for sale. And all of that really just leads to a lot less fruit coming out of an orchard. And overseas, it's been a really big problem, very, very costly, not just because of the damage, but also to manage. And that's why getting an early start can help bring down those costs if you can avoid sort of early stage where suddenly you realize there's a lot of damage there and the problem's already expanded.
That's Dr. Aliyah Patel finishing that report from Simone Smith. And some more texts earlier, we were talking about that shocking attack. A man has been attacked and killed by a deer on a property at Moreau near Wangaratta. John from Bragalong says, why do we say that the deer was euthanized when it was probably shot? Can't we face reality? And another text saying, do we think that maybe now the powers that be will accept that there is a problem with feral deer? And on dairy, Nigel says the National Milk Pool Co-op could save the dairy industry and deliver sustainable farm gate prices. Thanks for your text, Nigel. 0467 842 722, the number to get in touch. Well, now for something completely different for lunch. Cane toad garum and thistle tacos are on the menu at the Museum of Old and New Art in Hobart. Eat the Problem is a new exhibition which explores the potential for pests as gourmet dishes. Hugh Hogan has the story.
Pests are a problem for farmers all over Australia. In this kitchen, they're working on recipes to turn our biggest problems into delicacies. Vince Trim is the executive chef at the Museum of Old and New Art in Hobart. He's preparing a menu for the Eat the Problem exhibition.
So basically we've got 9 courses and we don't really actually have an entree and we don't have a starting point, we don't have a finishing point. What we have is we have 9 colours. So we've actually, our first colour is white and that's going to be camel milk. So we're going to make a beautiful dessert with camel milk. And then around that, we're going to put a few little treats and so forth, some rose hip and other invasive sort of weeds that are sweet and beautiful. Red's our next colour. And for the red, we're going to be doing hare, possum, pigeon, starling. Those are all going to be sort of worked together. We're going to make a beautiful possum and a hare tortellini. We've been making some lovely consommés. We're still experimenting with these dishes because we've had to get them bought in. Like, we've been actually going out and harvesting them, and, you know, to experiment. These aren't things that we normally use, so we've been doing different dishes with them. So that works. It's still in progress with that one there.
And you're also, we're looking towards the oceans, looking to use the long spine sea urchin, which is a terrible problem down here in Tasmania.
Yeah, massive problem, isn't it? With the sea urchin and also with wakame, both of those. So we'll bring those two dishes together. We've got an amazing collaboration with Adam James, who's made a garum with long spine sea urchin, and we're going to make some cocktails with it. We've been dehydrating it. There's so many actual uses for that.
It's not just animal pests. You're also utilising a lot of weeds throughout all of the dishes. Is that correct?
Weeds will be in every dish in some way, which is great. And I cannot believe how many weeds we have here. I was unaware. The weeds seem to be the biggest problem that we have. So look, we're going to be doing thistle. We're going to make some beautiful thistle purees, and then we'll make those into tortillas, and we'll do a thistle taco with dandelion and fat hen and you know, so forth. And the list goes on with there, chickweeds and everything. So weeds will be beautiful.
The next colour, is it blue?
So this one here, there's not much blue food. So we had to think about this one, and one of the things that we really wanted to use was the cane toad. So It's a long stretch to go blue and cane toad, but what we've brought the problem together again with sugarcane is we've made a dressing. We've made another garum. So Adam's created this amazing garum made out of cane toad, and we're going to actually infuse it with sugarcane. And so to bring those two things together, to bring the problem to the original problem, they had the original problem with the sugarcane, hence we have this problem with these insidious toads. So it's actually, and it's, look, it's delicious. Cane toad garum is delicious. So we've brought that together. And then to bring the blue in there, we're going to use a blue caviar on that. So it's actually, the dish itself will end up being our really extravagant, high-end, high society dish of caviar with cane toad.
I don't think it's called a main, but what's the next one up?
Yeah, so purple. Purple, of course, now this is an ongoing conversation, I think, particularly in Tasmania. In fact, it's a conversation everywhere around deer and farm deer and wild shot deer. And we certainly would love to be able to have access to the wild shot deer as a resource. I know it's very contentious, but there is a lot of deer in the wild that are getting culled. Because they're of the problems that they're causing for farmers. And currently we can't have access to that meat commercially, and we would love to have access to that. You know, good for them, good for the people that can hunt and supply the meat, you know, good for the customer. And I think that would also sit well. I mean, I understand that there's a farming industry, but we can both, you know, sit well together and get people actually using and consuming more deer.
That's Vince Trim, executive chef at the Museum of Old and New Art in Hobart, speaking to Hugh Hogan. Right now, it's off to the markets. $74, $72, $70, thank you. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70. $70 And today it's just the one. It's Wodonga Cattle with Leanne Dax.
Good afternoon. Leading into the Easter holiday break, it was a very small offering at Wodonga with only 142 cows and 6 bulls. Despite this, demand was solid over all weights and grades. Heavy cows lifted 4 cents, 192 to 211. The middle run of D2 and D3 types held firm, 128 to 168. The dairy portion, 140 to 168. And bulls made from 140 to 195. I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
Thanks, Leanne, and thanks for all your texts and getting involved in the conversation today on the Country Hour. That's all we've got time for. Enjoy this, rather warm day, and I'll be back with you tomorrow.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.